Hello, welcome back to the Victory Kitchen. Thank you for your patience as I've been on a little bit of a hiatus. This episode is number 30. Look what the stork dropped in. Yes, this episode is about babies in wartime. Now, because the world of babies is so vastly different between today and back in the 40s, I think it's worth examining the general world of babyhood in wartime before we get to what we normally talk about on this podcast, which is rationing. So first up, we're going to be talking about babies in propaganda, wartime baby population and hospitals versus home birth, shortages of baby essentials, and finally, rationing for babies. Now, rationing of baby food might not be for all the reasons you'd think, and there is a villain to this story, one so devious and selfish the government rationed baby food to protect Junior's food supply. So get ready, we're gonna dive right in. Welcome to the Victory Kitchen, the podcast all about American food rationing during World War II. I'm your host, Sarah Creviston Lee, author, historian, and vintage foodie. I'll be exploring the logistics of food rationing, featuring wartime cookbooks and recipes, and highlighting real homefront experiences. We're going to be learning exactly what our grandmothers had to do to get their food to fight for victory. So you might be wondering, why are we talking about babies? And I had this idea for two reasons. One was because occasionally I see questions about babies, like did they have ration books and things like that. So I started thinking, how big of an impact did the war have on babies? And that was a huge rabbit hole, as I came to find out. And the second reason was because last year, a lot of mothers were experiencing baby formula shortages. And I just thought this was really poignant for our time to kind of look at wartime restrictions mothers were dealing with, and kind of, you know, we can kind of commiserate together with these wartime mothers and today, you know, with the restrictions we have just based on our own circumstances. So I just thought it was an interesting parallel that we could relate to. Now, in my research, I noticed that in the 1940s, they were celebrating National Baby Week. This took place in the last week of April, beginning of May. So in 1942, this was April 26th to May 2nd. As far as I could tell, this National Baby Week was created to educate parents about keeping baby healthy. As part of this National Baby Week in 42, President Roosevelt proclaimed that May 1st was Child Health Day and called upon the people in each community to, quote, contribute to the conservation of child health and the reduction of illness among children, close quote, by getting their children aged 9 months and older vaccinated against diphtheria and smallpox, two diseases which had been especially devastating to children in the past. And I would think this was especially poignant cause for President Roosevelt, who was a victim of polio himself. And we will get back to baby health in a little bit. So I thought this was interesting. And the other interesting aspect of Baby Week was that it was like Black Friday for shops and merchants. They definitely took advantage of this week. So many ads in the war years, and I'm sure beyond, but I was just focusing on the war years. But they have this baby slant, even if they're not selling specific baby things. Stoves, paint, dairies, photo studios, washing machines, and then there's hospitals, of course, you know, health water, diaper services, grocery stores, and all the baby goods they sold, department stores touting their baby department, shoe stores, and of course, war bonds, etc. And it's so much fun to look at these ads and how they squeezed a baby angle out of everything. Speaking of squeezing baby angles out of things, let's talk about babies in wartime propaganda and political and commercial art. Now, I don't know if you've seen a lot of this type of art, but if you look at a lot of wartime propaganda from World War II, even World War I was, I think, even more prevalent. But you see a lot of use of babies and children, but it's the babies that I've noticed are especially heart-wrenching. But I've noticed they have particular themes. I've kind of broken them down into three different themes. One is a reminder of what they were fighting for. And there's this one particular poster that says, "Keep these hands off, buy the new victory bonds." And it shows a mother holding this vulnerable baby while the scary shadow claws of Germany and Japan are reaching out for them. A second category would be humor. And there's this one poster I found that is a war bond poster. It shows this really grumpy baby, or he looks kind of grumpy and angry, I don't know. And it says, "What do you mean you ain't gonna buy no bonds?" He looks a little bit like Winston Churchill. And I'll have these pictures on my blog so you can see. But so just using that kind of humor to grab people's attention. Then there is the category of pulling at your heartstrings or guilt. There's this one poster that's got this, it's a little bit older of a baby, I would say probably 18 months old. And it's really cute, chubby cheeks and these wide blue eyes. And it says, "To have and to hold, buy war bonds." You know, this baby's just like staring into your soul. You know, you got to preserve this child's innocence. So all of these different uses of babies for various purposes, I guess it depends on what the purpose of the propaganda was for, or the political or commercial art. It's just very interesting. So the next time that you're looking around at wartime art or propaganda, you know, just take a look at how they use babies. I think it's really fascinating. Now, there was a huge population boom in the United States during the war, and this was due to babies being born. And in a 1945 newspaper, it said, so this is towards the end of the war, it said there was a 27% increase in the birth rate since the war began. That's huge. That's so many children being born. Now, as a result of this, you know, most men were off fighting or working long hours. So mothers were caring for babies on their own or with the help of family or friends. There were a lot of busy mothers. And also, I wanted to mention babies were being born out of wedlock in the U.S. This was definitely a taboo topic at the time, but it is a fact of history. And in the book, Our Mother's War by Emily Yellen, she states that the rate of babies that were born to unmarried women during World War II rose 3% per 1,000 babies from 1939 to 1945. Now, I really wanted to talk about child care. This is a really fascinating topic, but I did not have time in this episode. So if you'd like to learn more about the shortage of child care and how that was dealt with, Emily Yellen talks more about that in her book, Our Mother's War. I would just recommend reading that book anyway. It's a super fascinating book that covers women and so many of the roles that they took on during the war. I highly recommend. Okay, so next we're moving on to hospitals versus home births. This was something I knew nothing about. I really was starting from scratch, but I really felt like I needed to get an understanding of babies in wartime by looking at where they were being born. My grandmothers aren't around for me to ask about this, where they were born. I guess, I mean, I could look it up, but I just needed to know some of those details that I like to know when talking to you guys about it. So I did a lot of digging in newspapers, and I also got some lovely comments from people on Instagram telling about their parents or their own experiences. So thank you for that. So hospitals versus home births. So hospitals were taxed not only due to shortages of doctors and nurses and supplies, but because there was this baby boom. One newspaper article stated, "It was recorded the other day that a nearby hospital now had the situation so much better in hand that mothers would no longer have to leave 3 days after their babies were born to make space for newcomers." So the article also assures readers that babies born at home are just as good as those born in hospitals. So I think this reflects that the trend shifting to babies being born in hospitals versus being born at home. For a long time, of course, babies were born at home, but as healthcare was getting better at hospitals, you know, home births were used to be the go-to thing, but hospital births had been on the rise because doctors found it more convenient and having skilled help on hand in case of an emergency was helpful. And then I also found that a mother staying for a week in the hospital after a baby was born was more common, but the war was changing all of that. In a 1942 article in the Asheville Citizen Times from January 1942, it had this headline: "One out of every four babies here is born at home." So just one out of every four. Then later that year, the St. Louis Globe-Democrat, so this is now in April, stated from the summary of a conference that home is a safer birthplace than most hospitals. And I really wanted to read you this article because this has the most interesting information. This woman is very adamant about home births, and it just provides some really interesting information for that time. It says, "Fewer and fewer American babies are being born at home these days, but Dr. Beatrice E. Tucker, medical director of Chicago Maternity Center, says there are all kinds of hospitals and she would rather see a baby born in the poorest home than in any but the very best hospital. Dr. Tucker, whose demonstration of streamlined home delivery innovations was one of the highlights yesterday at the opening day of the Second American Congress on Obstetrics and Gynecology, said her opinion was there aren't very many of those very best hospitals. For the most part, such hospitals are found only in the larger cities. Many hospitals with excellent facilities for surgery and medicine," she said, "are forced for financial reasons to skimp on the obstetrical plant." There was authority in Dr. Tucker's view of the home or hospital delivery question. In its 9 years of existence, Chicago Maternity Center has performed 26,000 home deliveries and lost only four mothers. This record has convinced Dr. Tucker and others in the field that the hazard of fatal infection is greater in the improperly equipped hospital than in the home when the attending doctor knows the home delivery technique. Unless the hospital is a maternity unit or has a well-isolated obstetrical floor, the patient is better off at home, Dr. Tucker explained. Isolation means isolation of the mother from persons suffering from any of the many infectious or contagious diseases. In even the slum neighborhoods, where the center does its work, she said, there is seldom a sick person in the adjoining room. Also, she pointed out, the mother usually has become conditioned physically to her home environment and has developed an immunity to whatever bacteria is normally present in her home. The equipment employed by the center is remarkable for its simplicity and ingenuity. The doctor brings to the home only two pre-sterilized items, a can of cotton and a can of pads. His other instruments are sterilized by boiling at the scene. It goes on to describe that instead of using sheets, they use newspapers that they sterilize in the patient's kitchen stove. And that in 1941, the center's home delivery record was one death and 2,167 live births. Finally, Dr. Tucker concluded, "The ideal place for a maternity case is a well-equipped, well-managed maternity hospital. The second choice is a hospital with a well-isolated obstetrical floor. Next best is the home, but expectant mothers can rest assured that their doctors know all that. No good doctor will take his patient to an inadequate hospital." So I just found all this information, exactly what I was looking for. I just found her defense of home birth really interesting and informative for all of these points that the mother is used to her home environment. She is adapted to whatever germs are there. And so as opposed to going to a hospital that's maybe not the greatest, you know, she is exposed to a lot more germs that she is not accustomed to. I also wanted to make a very important note here that much of the baby literature and propaganda I viewed in my course of research was aimed at white parents and adults. But I think it's important to point out at this period in time, hospitals were still segregated. There were some black hospitals like St. Philip in Virginia, but they were sparse and mostly concentrated in larger cities and in the South. A larger percentage of black women delivered their babies at home with the attendance of a midwife, though that wasn't the case everywhere. I found two really interesting sources on this topic if you'd like to do further study. One was on the website for Duke University Medical Center Library and Archives. They have a page for Black History Month dedicated just to talking about the Black hospital movement from 1865 to 1960s, which was very informative. And the second source was from the University of New Hampshire. It's a 2014 paper by Carrie L. Hunkeley, which I hope I pronounced that right, called Segregation in United States Healthcare from Reconstruction to Deluxe Jim Crow. You can search specifically for World War II if you'd like to read about healthcare during this time period. The parts that I read had very important information, which I'd recommend reading, and I will have the links to those sources on my blog. Naturally, because of population increase or this baby explosion, there were shortages of baby things everywhere. Now, it was kind of, depending on where you lived, there were different types of shortages. For instance, baby bottles. In some places where there was a large baby population increase, like Washington State, baby bottles were scarce. And I shared this on Instagram. A woman in a Life magazine article suggested reusing Coca-Cola and beer bottles for babies' milk bottles, because the smaller rubber nipples fit onto the tops. So if you don't mind judgy stares, I guess that would work. But I mean, you know, make use of the bottles you've got. I don't know if the glass shortage was affecting this at all. I'm not sure. I think it was just the demand, the super high demand, and they couldn't keep up production. The second thing was baby bottle nipples. In the Roanoke World News from Virginia in March of 1942 came this report. From some parts of the country come reports that rubber nipples are scarce because airplane motor manufacturers are using them as ideal protectors for motor valves during construction. So in other words, they were being used to keep out dirt. I know, like, modern baby bottle nipples come with the holes pre-punctured. So when I was thinking of this, I thought, well, how is it keeping out anything if the holes were already there? But looking through the baby books I have from the time, they actually have instructions of how to pierce the holes in the baby nipple because they don't come pre-pierced. This way you could puncture however many holes you needed for your baby, depending on their age. So they just came with no holes. And so that makes sense about why these airplane motor manufacturers were using them. Great, guys. That was only in areas where there were these manufacturers, though, because there were other reports in newspapers saying, well, we've heard of this problem, but there aren't any manufacturers in the area, so we don't have any concerns of running into a shortage. So there's that. The next shortage that I found was for safety pins. This was definitely blamed on the birth increase. Another paper in 1944 blamed it on the manpower shortage where safety pins were being made. In the Springfield Daily News of Ohio, they complained that the quality had eroded since the war started. It said, the situation is further aggravated by the lowered quality of the limited supply of common pins and safety pins that now are available. These are wartime makeshifts, dealers declare, and they are made of a poorer grade steel, are lighter in weight, and less durable. They bend more easily and are not nickel-plated or brassed, as were the pre-war pins. Therefore, they corrode and stain cloth and bandages. Actually, this kind of made me think a little bit because I have some things from wartime, like cookbooks where there are pins in them. They literally pinned pages with paper recipes in there. And sometimes the pins are corroded, but sometimes they're not. So it made me think for a second, maybe some of these pins were pre-war and some were wartime quality pins. So yeah, that is so interesting. But if you've ever had to pin a baby cloth diaper with inferior safety pin, it's the worst. Now, not just safety pins were the problem. They were having problems with diapers. This was a huge grievance for parents. There were less people working and there was less gas for diaper cleaning services. I found this cheeky little article written by Robert W. Richards from the San Pedro News Pilot from California called Diaper Shortage Big Issue, coming out of Washington. It says there have been suffragette, anti-war, commie, and bonus marches on the Capitol. Comes now something new in the way of protest hoofing, this one at a definite toddle, by babies of outraged Army, Navy, and war worker families to complain that government simply has ignored the essentiality of the eternal triangle, which, referring to their diapers. The tots, convoyed by their mothers, of course, will wail that while they have been arriving at a rate certainly satisfactory to war board officials, the experts of that federal bureau simply have failed to provide an essential to their well-being and healthy development, diapers. In the face of WPB's defense that there are plenty of three-cornered pants available, angry mothers have called upon congresswomen, most of them mamas in their own right, to tell WPB and OPA that it just ain't so, and to ask the distaff salons to investigate the seat of the trouble. Oh my. Mothers joining forces with national maternity organizations and operations of Diddy Services aim to get right to the bottom of the shortage. The National Diaper Service insists that there haven't been enough reaching them to supply the rapidly increasing baby population. This below-the-belt whack at new papas and mamas, prides and joys is resented. While Washington has no corner on the Diddy situation, for it's critical everywhere, the congestion of newlywed service folk and bureaucrats into sprawling apartment developments here makes the plaint of parents for more frequent changes for posterity more apparent, even to the most casual observer. It is not unusual to see a captain or a major, they don't rank much below that in these parts, or a two or three striper luxing his newborn's trough in communal laundry washers or mayhap in the kitchen sink. Capital department stores are sold out. Many don't even have the material from which this necessary article can be stitched up at home. Special laundry services for babies are so overworked, they must perforce refuse any new customers. Yet infants continue to roll off the production line without regard for the banshee screams of Washington for more food, a place to sleep, a bit of gas, and a package of cigarettes. Don't you know there's a war on? Meant nothing in their young lives. Oh my gosh. So, it does go on, but I had never seen so many puns crammed into an article. So, I was laughing quite a bit when I first read this. But this is in January of 1945. So, I mean, it might be because the population just is still increasing and the problems haven't gone away. And they bring up an important point, and that is that there is not enough cloth for diapers. But first, we're going to talk about the diaper services. They are stretched thin. And I found a lot of research about diaper services. there was one word of advice in a Missouri newspaper that was telling expectant mothers to reserve their supply of diapers 2 to 3 months in advance of their future delivery. So they were, you know, swamped with customers. They had to be kind of selective. They had some services had even stopped delivering to rural areas because of the gas restrictions and the rubber shortages. Some diaper services stopped taking new customers altogether, but some services would take them if the customers could supply their own diapers. The Buffalo Evening News of New York in February of 43 reported that there was a check of three major diaper manufacturers who disclosed that at the end of 1942, diaper production was 16 million yards short of the previous year's production. So they were deluged with orders and only able to fill half of them. One of the diaper mills, Dundee, said that the War Production Board on February 1st requested that they continue the operation of 50 diaper looms, which it had planned to convert to war production. So they were going to take away 50 of their looms, but changed their mind when they saw how desperately they needed to keep them in production. So, yeah. I guess they didn't count for all the babies that were going to be born. Now, these were not the only shortages that there were. There were shortages of other things. Rubber sheets, you know, for baby's bed. Rubber pants for the cloth diapers. Wool blankets and wool baby wear. There were no more zippered baby clothes. Many stores expected their steel-framed baby buggies and mattress frames to be replaced with wooden-framed ones. So imagine that, a wooden-framed baby buggy or stroller type thing. Another interesting thing I hadn't even thought about was one newspaper talked about that beloved toy dogs and pandas, once favorite gifts from oldsters, are no longer as huggable as before because that excellent milkweed derivative stuffing, Kapok, has also gone to war. Cotton, which soon grows lumpy, fills their tummies. No more hard rubber toys can be purchased, and infants now have to grow molars without the aid of traditional rubber teethers, as one mother was dismayed to learn at a local counter. I had never thought of that. I didn't even realize that toys were stuffed with Kapok. I mean, I knew that children collected milkweed as part of the war effort for a replacement in life vests. And because of that, they were no longer going into toys. I didn't even know. So that, I mean, now that I think about it, I think that would make a lovely stuffing for an animal. It's so soft, but not in wartime. And then the rubber toys for teethers, such a shame. Poor babies. I'm sure mothers got, you know, very creative and finding things for the babies to teeth on. But yeah, that is so sad. Now, the most concerning shortage of all was healthcare. Clara Savage Littledale, the editor of Parents Magazine, gave a warning cry on this count. She pointed out that many military and industrial defense areas, as well as other communities, had a shortage of maternal and child care facilities and medical and nursing care. This problem extended to rural areas where doctors were being pulled away from military service, leaving them and the other citizens without adequate medical attention. Yeah, this would be very concerning. And I came across numerous bits of advice telling mother how to keep herself and her baby healthy because there was a lack of doctors and nurses. And it was better to take better measures in advance than to burden an already overburdened medical system. And in fact, I just was looking through one of my farm journal magazines, and it was talking about farm women empowering themselves in many different ways. And one of the ways was to educate themselves in the ways of nursing, because so many of the doctors, the country doctors, had been taken away for, you know, military service. So women were doing something about it. And in some cases, they are being asked to do something about it. You need to learn and educate yourself and how to take care of yourself better and your baby, because, yeah, there's not as many doctors around. Other interesting tidbits of advice I found, these are just kind of random. One was, be careful with your child in traffic. Put them in a car seat. Don't put them on your lap or lay them on the seat of the car. I know this seems kind of obvious, but, you know, in a time when, I mean, cars, like, were everyone, it was starting to become kind of normal to have a car. You know, car safety with children was still probably kind of a new idea. So this actually is, you know, maybe new information for some people. Cross only at intersections and follow the traffic lights. They also talked about sleep baby in his own little bed. Don't take him into bed with you. And finally, that as strange as it sounds, an active baby older than 4 months actually is safer sleeping in the dry bathtub than on an adult's bed. I wonder if this was probably for the risk of falling off. So I just found that interesting. So there is so much mother advice out there in regards to babies. This was just from a particular article. And now finally, the moment we've been waiting for, food rationing for baby. Now, babies did have ration books. I think this is maybe the most common question did baby have a ration book? Yes. Everyone from the oldest grandparent down to the youngest child had a ration book. This enabled the family to get enough food rations for everyone in the family. Now, what foods were rationed for baby? Were their foods rationed? Yes. But not everything. So canned foods like glass and tin cans, which were generally in the 4.5 or 6.5 ounce containers, were rationed. One article explains it. Strained foods to be rationed include vegetables such as carrots and string beans, as well as vegetable and tomato soup, and a number of vegetable combinations. Fruit such as prunes and peaches. Fruit combinations such as apricots and apples, or pears and pineapples. Fruits prepared as desserts, consisting either of fruits to which sugar has been added, or as fruit pudding, such as prune pudding, pineapple and rice, or custard. Meats and meat broths in combination with vegetables, strained for infant feeding, also will be rationed. So the things that were not rationed were canned milk formulas, prepared cereals. Those were not. So why were these things rationed? It was not necessarily because supplies were short yet, but it was in order to safeguard baby's food supply. But safeguard it from what? Here is where we come to the villain of this story. Adults were buying up baby food to eat for themselves. That's right, folks. The villain of this story were the adults. In the Kansas City Star, in January of 1943, this was the headline, many baby foods to be rationed to prevent their misuse by adults. It says, if baby foods were not rationed, they might be bought extensively as a substitute for rationed canned goods. Such buying would cut sharply into available supplies and would soon dislocate normal marketing. This was in January 1943, before full-time rationing had begun. Now, almost as soon as rationing started, their fears were realized. So in the Lincoln Journal Star, the 30th of March 1943, it says, it is reported from Chicago that childless adults are buying low-point baby foods and using them for soup. That brings on a baby food shortage with no penalty for those guilty that seems to fit. This just seems so wrong. Oh my gosh. And it's not like these things were not labeled as baby food. No. They are clearly baby foods. They are specific brands of baby foods out there. Gerber and what's the other brand? Oh, I can't see it right now. But there were specific brands of baby foods. And I'm sure they were all grouped together at the grocery store. You had to ask specifically for these things if the grocer was the one that waited on you. There was no mistaking. Like, oh, oops, I grabbed the baby food instead of the soup over here or whatever. Oh my gosh. Now, these were not the only villains. There were also the war profiteers and more. In the Ironwood Daily Globe in July of 1943, it says, "Baby food has become a morale factor on our fighting fronts. Young soldier fathers are troubled by rumors that their infant sons and daughters may not get enough to eat because of food shortages, black markets, and the threat of inflation. Nazi propaganda plays up these fears. How real is the danger? Well, we are definitely approaching a shortage of canned baby foods. Our birth rate is up 17%, but baby food processors have only as much tin as last year and 25% more glass. They are stretched to production of about 40 million dozen cans to meet a potential demand for about 250 million dozen from those babies under 2 years to whom OPA has issued ration books. The illegitimate use of finely divided baby foods by adults has also drastically cut supplies. So has the increased demand due to bigger incomes from war jobs. Although the government blocked the threat to our egg supply by keeping new eggs out of cold storage, the Ohio Bakers Association reports that our supply is now endangered by lack of corn poultry feed. Many farmers are feeding corn to their hogs because they get more for it that way than by selling it by the bushel as chicken feed. Milk is the most important baby food. There is a possibility of a shortage, especially in overpopulated industrial centers. And black market prices are encouraging many farmers to sell their dairy cows past maximum milk production age for beef. Donald E. Montgomery, Consumers Council, warns that fathers on the fighting front should indeed be worried about their youngsters back home. The war they are winning can be lost by profit-crazed madmen here, he adds, unless the American people immediately back the president in his fight for controls and food price rollbacks. Labor feels also that preferential rationing for mothers and infants is essential on certain foods, especially milk. But something is being done about it. The OPA established medical advisors to grant extra supplies for children with special needs and recently added canned milk to rationed foods in an attempt to conserve the limited supplies for infants. The government is beginning to release 7 million cases of evaporated milk, about 12% of our normal annual consumption, formerly held in storage for Army and Navy and Lend-Lease purposes. Dry powdered milk takes up less space on ships. Furthermore, many neighborhood grocers and delicatessen owners are refusing to sell canned milk or baby food to customers unless they know they have babies. Favorable news comes from manufacturers of Farina and other cereal for babies. They do not foresee any shortage. Makers of drugstore baby foods report adequate supplies. These include dehydrated powdered milk food, liquid modified milk, and a vegetable milk made largely from soybeans for children allergic to cow's milk. They are unrationed but expensive. Dr. Edward P. Daly of the Children's Bureau, Department of Labor, reminds young mothers that their own milk is still the best for infants. Most young women can breastfeed their babies if they have proper prenatal care, he says. The War Food Administration admits a watchful eye is being kept on the baby food supply. The needs of babies are known by the Civilian Requirements Branch, and if a shortage should develop, they promise that some sort of preferential rationing will be set up. Our food goes to the armed forces first, next to civilians, and then to our allies. The Regional Office of the Food Distribution Administration promises that if any extreme shortage arises, infants, expectant, and nursing mothers will certainly come first in the civilian group. Some doctors believe they should be placed even before the armed forces. I felt this article was really important because of all the information that's in here. Now, this is 1943, July, so rationing had not, like, full-time rationing had not been in place for too long. Just a few months. So let's recap what this article is saying. The birth rate is up 17%. Baby food producers are stretched on container supplies with more demand but restricted by their previous year's production caps. There's illegitimate use of baby foods by adults. And there's an increased demand of baby food due to bigger income from wartime jobs. And I think I would like to add that people are busier and pre-made baby foods are more convenient. So maybe they're making less baby food at home. Then there's the egg supply, which is an easy baby food. for those that are eating solid foods. That's threatened by the shortage of poultry feed. Then there's a milk shortage threatened by the black market of beef and farmers killing their dairy cows for meat sales. There's war profiteers. And then labor feels there should be preferential rationing for mothers and infants, especially with milk. The OPA is acting on things. There's extra supplies for babies with special needs. They've added canned milk to ration foods, and they're releasing reserves of evaporated milk to consumers. Many neighborhood grocers are refusing to sell baby food to customers unless they know they have babies. Hip, hip, hooray for the neighborhood grocers. Yeah, so I think that those are all very important points. I'd also like to, in case you didn't catch it, that they're talking about the vegetable milk. This is soy milk for babies that were allergic to cow milk. So that was available back then. You don't really hear much about that in wartime, but babies and people had allergies to cow milk even back then. So yeah, lots of things going on. I think this article is so fantastic because it's not just pointing at one thing. It's really taking the whole problem apart and saying there's lots of things adding and contributing to this problem. Now, not everyone bought this rationed baby food. You could make it at home, and many people did make it at home. And making baby food at home was easy, especially if you had tools like a food mill, a strainer, and a meat grinder. If a woman did canning, she usually had these tools anyway. One newspaper gave advice for preparing and canning your own baby food. The Spokane Review out of Washington in June of 1943 gave this advice. With the many victory gardens that are being grown, many mothers will want to can their baby's foods at home to relieve the situation of baby food shortage. So they say that you should only can your baby's food if you have a pressure canner available. Choose fresh vegetables to feed your baby over canned vegetables. Garden fresh vegetables in their prime condition for the highest vitamin quality. Cook them quickly in a small amount of water. All utensils used must be sterilized from the sieve to the spoon to the container the vegetables are put into. Cleanliness with baby's food is most important. So I think that's kind of general information with just cooking. Oh yeah, making your own baby food. And then for canning vegetables or soups for babies' winter meals, use half pint jars if you have those available. These small jars are not being manufactured, but if you have them on hand, they'll be fine for the use of small quantity canning. Then heat only the amount of food needed and leave the remainder in the jar in which it was canned and store in a refrigerator until ready to use for another meal. So lots of great advice for making baby food at home. So in conclusion, in a time of war, babies, above all else, symbolized faith. This article in the Springfield Daily News from Ohio illustrates this idea so well. So this is the National Baby Week of 1945. National Baby Week assumes special significance this year as peace-loving peoples united to bring an end to the horror, bloodshed, and grief in the war-torn world today, believe that having babies proves faith in the future. Faith in a world that will be a desirable place for the rearing of children. So they were just a couple months from total victory. The end of the dark tunnel was in sight for so many people, but it was just about to begin for others. The children that come from this generation are those that we continue to look to for their wisdom and life's lessons. My hope is that we can keep carrying on that faith into the future. We can keep sharing this history with our children so that our world will be a hopeful, beautiful place for everyone. Today's cookbook feature is The Prenatal Diet. This was a book published by the Carnation Company. So it's another of these lovely product booklets. And of course, the cookbook recipes are all about the Carnation evaporated milk. This book is part advice book and part cookbook. So it has information on what an adequate diet is for an expecting mother. And I found this part interesting. Of course, milk was always something that, especially in the 40s, that mothers were told they needed to drink. And in this book, it says, in a very conversational manner, we shall need at least 2 to 3 quarts of liquid a day. 1 quart is milk. The remainder must be water, soup, and other liquids such as fruit juice drinks. This liquid intake acts as a solvent for food and waste material and stimulates the activity of kidneys, skin, and bowels. Alcohol has no place in our diet unless ordered by our doctor. Tea and coffee, if he approves, should be taken in moderation. We now become iron-willed and pass up fried foods, pastries, rich desserts, rich salad dressings, and any food which ordinarily disagrees with us. We should take our meals with regularity, eat slowly, and masticate thoroughly. In other words, chew thoroughly. 3 meals a day will suffice during the first half of pregnancy. The need for additional food after that may be supplied by lunches of milk, cocoa, or broth, and crackers or toast between meals and upon retiring. If we have a tendency to nausea early in pregnancy, we may control it by taking a little food every 2 hours instead of the usual 3 meals. So-called, quote-unquote, cravings are not as common, in fact, as they are in rumor, but we may have a capricious appetite and display strange likes and dislikes. Possibly because of the tendency to nausea, these whims should not be indulged. If we are well and have no symptoms of complications, we shall be able to supply our own and baby's needs if we select our diet from such groups as the following: milk, vegetables, fruits, meat, fish and poultry, eggs, cereals and bread, liquids, desserts. Wow. I don't know. If you told like a pregnant woman today that these same types of things about their cravings, and that they have to be iron-willed to pass up like pastries and other things like that, I think they might try to tackle you. So, I mean, oh man. So this is the advice portion. They also talk about the different food categories. Like it says, it has a huge portion about the importance of milk, vitamins, some helpful suggestions for what to provide for babies, clothing and layette, bassinet for the bath, what to take to the hospital. That's useful. And then so many good things to eat. It's got menus and then, of course, the recipes. The recipe that I tried was voted on by my lovely supporters on Patreon. They voted for scalloped noodles and stuffed eggs. This involved 4.5 ounces of packaged noodles, 6 hard-cooked eggs, mustard, salt and pepper, a little vinegar, a little carnation milk, 2 cups buttered breadcrumbs, 1.5 tablespoons butter, 2 tablespoons flour, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1 cup of boiling water, 1 cup of carnation milk, grated cheese, if desired. Oh man, trust me, you desire it for this one. This recipe was white on white on white. It was just so bland. So you boil the noodles in the salted water until they're tender. You drain them and rinse them. Then you place them in a buttered casserole. Then you cut the eggs in half. You mix the yolk with the mustard, salt, pepper, and vinegar, and then the carnation milk to moisten it. And I thought that was interesting. So it's kind of a replacement for mayo, I guess. Then you fill the whites with the egg yolk mixture. Then you place the eggs on top of the noodles. You melt the butter and you make this white sauce with the flour, the salt, and the water. Why? Why would you make white sauce with water? I think that was the first thing gone wrong with this recipe. You do add the milk. After it thickens, you add the cup of milk. But really, I think it should have been milk all the way. And then it says to pour over the eggs and noodles, top with cheese and the crumbs. And yeah, it wasn't. So you brown it in the oven and you serve it warm. It wasn't that it was bad. It was just kind of boring. And I think what could have helped it along was putting the cheese, like a nice strong cheese, like cheddar, into the white sauce. So it became a cheese sauce. I think that would have definitely changed the game a lot and made sure it was like almost, yeah, like a macaroni and cheese, but noodles, just egg noodles. That's how I would have changed it. And definitely added some spices. I know this is supposed to be like maybe gentle on the stomach, but come on. I mean, I think it, depending on the pregnant woman, of course, you know, whatever spices she can handle, you can definitely put some of that in here. So that's my advice. Whatever she can handle, she could eat it. Now, this is a prenatal cookbook. It doesn't necessarily have food for babies in here. Well, it does suggest that you can use carnation milk for baby's formula. It doesn't have a recipe for the formula, but it's saying you can use our brand to make your formula. And in the mother's baby book that I have from wartime, there are recipes in there for a formula that uses evaporated milk. So this was a common thing from that time, to use evaporated milk. They considered it to be a good sterile milk that was clean for baby to drink. So while today we find that kind of odd, back then it was considered perfectly safe to use. So they didn't use just straight evaporated milk. They did add some things to it to make the formula. So anyway, that is the recipe. I will have that on my blog for you to try and modify if you so wish. For today's story highlight, I wanted to honor the work of George Anna Saunders. She was written about in the Roanoke World News in Virginia on 20th of February, 1942, by Norwood Middleton. She was a Black woman from Salem, Virginia, and was a midwife who worked for 32 years and delivered 2,764 babies. Now, in this article, he interviewed her, but I didn't want to read the article itself because what I found from this particular time period is that, I mean, they write out her accent. And what I found in this time period is that anytime they do that, it is, however subconscious or unintentional, it is derogatory. And it's either an indication of their race or that they're from the country and therefore unintelligent. And so I did not want to read that, but I really wanted to honor her incredible work. And I feel like that was the meaning behind this article. And so that is what I wanted to highlight. So she talks about how she delivered, so in total, the 2,764 babies in her career. But she delivered 2,375 babies without a doctor and 389 babies with a doctor. She delivered both white and Black babies from what she termed common class and the high class in Salem and the surrounding area. How she got started was by going out with several different doctors and learning from them, one of whom was Dr. W.V. Dillard. She called one of the finest doctors that ever walked. The doctors would engage her when they got a labor case, and she'd do what they told her to do. She wouldn't use any prescriptions either, but her philosophy was to let nature take its course. If the delivery was taking too long, though, she would call for the doctor if the mother wanted him. George Anna remembered there were many times she had to sit up long, slow-moving hours all day and night with a mother in her misery. To go do her work, she took with her a little suitcase and a bag that she'd take her things in, and in later years, it carried a batch of birth certificates. She delivered 7 sets of twins, and the heaviest baby she delivered was 17 pounds. And she talks about that poor mother, about how that poor mother labored quite a while to deliver that baby. She had 6 children of her own, and at the good age of 76, had to finally give up midwifery due to her poor health. So I just thought this was an incredible career, and it really highlights the importance of midwives, and especially to the Black community, where there were not a lot of healthcare facilities. There were not enough healthcare facilities for them. So her career was so important to her community, and I just think she's an awesome woman. Before I close, I wanted to give a special patron shout out to Amy. She has been supporting me at the Victory Kitchen sergeant level for over a year, and she is definitely overdue for a patron shout out. So thank you so much, Amy. I couldn't do what I do without your support, and I really appreciate your friendship as well. So thank you so much. And I am so grateful for all of my patrons. And if you are interested in supporting me on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/Victory Kitchen Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to see what I'm up to on Instagram, my handle is Victory Kitchen Podcast. I post all kinds of interesting things, a lot of things which I don't even post on my blog, research that I'm finding as I'm preparing for my podcast and recipes and things that I'm making. So you should head on over there and check things out. To access all the extra resources related to this episode, please go to my website, victorykitchenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.